BAI New York.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The previous program was the WBAI Evening News, heard daily at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion Radio coming up. It's 6:30 p.m.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion. Welcome to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent directive action to press for action on the climate emergency. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Ashagun Henry, who is Robert Noyce Career Development Professor in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Prior to joining MIT in 2018, Dr. Henry was assistant professor in mechanical engineering at Georgia Tech for 6 years. Prior to starting as a professor, he worked in the U.S. Department of Energy and also did a postdoc at Northwestern and Oak Ridge National Laboratory, completed his master's and PhD from MIT and bachelor's from Florida A&M University. Professor Henry has made significant advances and contributions to several fields in energy and heat transfer, and we'll be talking about some of the climate implications of those with him today. Dr. Henry, welcome to the Rebellion.
Thank you. Thank you. Excited to be here.
You were recently featured in MIT News, and that's part of how you came to our attention. The feature focused on the fact that you have this potentially game-changing idea about capturing renewable energy. Now, before we get into that, let's start off with some basics for listeners who might not know mechanical engineering and might not know much about renewable energy. Tell listeners about renewable energy. What is it, and why is it important to think about in terms of our climate crisis?
Yeah, it's a great question. The term renewable implies that it can be renewed versus, by contrast, the conventional forms of energy that we use in the power infrastructure and for transportation. It's all based on, not all, but mostly based on fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are fuels, hydrocarbons that are derived from organisms over a very long period of time. Hundreds of thousands of years, and they have resulted in deposits of hydrocarbons under the earth, oil, and also natural gas. Those resources are finite, and we generally refer to the resource that we can get from the sun as renewable, meaning we can renew it. We can keep pulling from it on a much longer time scale than we can pull from the hydrocarbons that are in the ground. And so that's the form of energy that we refer to as renewable. Solar energy or energy from the sun can basically take two main forms. There are actually a variety of different ways we utilize the sun for electricity specifically. One is what many people may be familiar with, is solar panels. The other is wind. The wind actually comes from the sun. So the wind is generated by convective currents, the heat, the sunlight hitting the earth, the ground warming up and then causing convective currents in the air that ultimately give rise to the wind. And those two main forms of energy or types of energy are the ones that we use. The reason many people are interested in using them and increasing their proliferation with regards to climate change is because those forms of energy do not directly result in the release of any chemicals or carbon dioxide specifically into the air. And that's the origin. That's one of the biggest culprits for climate change is the CO2 that's in the air, the carbon dioxide, which is primarily released when you use fossil fuels. You burn some form of hydrocarbon, and the carbon is key because the carbon bonds with oxygen and makes carbon dioxide. And that has built up in our atmosphere over the last five or six decades, or the last century or so, and has become a serious problem for lots of habitats, lots of ecosystems, and it's gradually encroaching on human ecosystems and displacing people, and ultimately will threaten human survival.
That's right. Now, right now, energy that's captured is, as MIT News points out, delivered in a use or lose capacity. Now, what does that mean, and why is that a problem?
Yeah, it's a great point. So over the last 20 to 30 years or so, the price of solar panels and wind has come down dramatically. And they are now cheaper than fossil fuels if you just count the price of solar or wind based on the total amount of money you spend building it and installing it, and then divide that by the total amount of energy you'll get out of it throughout the entire life of the device. And that's usually what we refer to as the levelized cost of electricity. And it accounts for all that you pay and all that you get. What it doesn't account for, though, is when you get it. So it does not make any assumptions or account for the fact that with solar energy, and let's say sun, solar panels, as an example, the way the physics works, the way the materials work inside of a solar panel, when they are struck with light and they interact with the light, you get the electricity available only at that time when the light is illuminating on the cells. Maybe one great example, many people, maybe I'm dating myself, but may remember little calculators that came out a long time ago that used to have a little little photovoltaic panel on it. And if you put your finger over it, it turns off.
You are dating yourself, I want to tell you.
Yeah, I remember those calculators.
Yeah, those little calculators had a little mini photovoltaic panel, which is just like a solar cell. And the point is, as soon as you cover it, as soon as you take away the light, the power goes away and it shuts off. And so the same is true for large solar panels that are providing electricity to the grid. If they are covered by cloud cover or it's nighttime, you don't get any electricity. And so the same is true generally for wind. If the wind is not blowing and the wind turbines are not spinning, then you don't get any electricity. So the electricity you get out of renewables is basically weather dependent. And the reason this is a problem is because human usage of electricity is not so weather dependent, meaning just about every day, whether it's cloudy or not, on a hot day, people want to come home and turn on their air conditioners. So we want electricity available at night if you want to go in your kitchen or if you want to do something. You want to be able to turn on the lights and you want the lights to come on, and you don't want to say, okay, well, because the sun's not out, I'm okay with not having lights right now. And so there is a need to bottle up, or what we call buffer, the electricity that we get when the weather is conducive. We need to put it in some form of storage vessel, hold it, and then when we now want electricity, put the electricity on the grid when people want it. And so the way the grid works right now is everything is synchronized. So there's a group of people in a room somewhere that try to predict how much electricity people are going to use in the next hour. They call up and they dispatch the turbines at the fossil power plants and tell them how much gas to burn to make sure that there's enough electricity for how much they expect people to use. Very large users of electricity, for example, if you're going to draw like 10 megawatts of electricity or more from the grid, you have to schedule it with the power grid. Like, they have to know, otherwise you would cause a blackout. So there's no storage buffer on the grid by and large right now. You don't get to just use as much electricity as you want. Most of the small fluctuations for an individual home or community are small enough that they're able to manage. But, we need to develop at a very large scale, giant batteries that are able to hold massive amounts of electricity from renewables and then put it on the grid whenever people want.
And that's what you're working on.
Exactly. Yeah.
Can you called it a box up to sun system. So can you explain this system of yours to our listeners?
Yeah, sure. The term that actually got coined in an MIT News article, an earlier one, was called a sun in a box, which actually came from one of my colleagues. And we were writing a proposal together, actually, and it involved similar technology. And basically the reason he coined that term was because what it involves is extremely high temperatures. Temperatures that are not as high as the sun, but so hot that the objects are glowing white hot, just like a light bulb, similar to at least what you see coming from the sun. And so the way it works is the problem we're trying to solve ultimately is that other forms of battery technology, like lithium ion, it's too expensive. So if you take solar panels and you add lithium ion batteries to store up the energy from the solar panels, the batteries will be more expensive than the panels are. The batteries are actually very expensive. And even though the cost is coming down, it keeps coming down, and people have their predictions for how low it will get. And even at the lowest predictions, it's still not low enough for us to fully decarbonize the grid and make a fully renewable grid. So there's kind of an international race going on. Lots of people are trying to develop what technology can possibly take its place at the grid level where you have giant, giant batteries. And so our approach is to instead use materials that are extremely cheap. And instead of storing electricity in the way that you store it in a normal battery, like a lithium ion battery, which is what's called electrochemical storage, you're storing it in the potential for an electrochemical reaction. In our case, we're storing the energy thermally. So we call ours thermal batteries. That's another name we use for it. And so a thermal battery, instead of storing electricity directly, it stores heat. And the reason we want to store heat is because heat is very, very inexpensive. In fact, today, if you look at heat usage on the entire energy system, you know, more than 90% of all the electricity in the world today comes from heat. It comes from either burning some kind of fuel or you're making that heat in a nuclear reactor or a concentrated solar power plant. But the majority of electricity comes from heat. And so what we do is we take in electricity and we use that electricity to run resistive heaters. And resistive heaters are basically just like a incandescent light bulb filament. So it's just a giant resistor. It's just a big, giant, light bulb. And that light that's coming out of our resistor is what we use to transfer the energy to our storage medium. And so we use liquid metal flowing inside of graphite piping. The entire system is held inside of an inert environment. So there's no air. It's an argon environment. And the graphite that we're using is able to hold liquid metal. The liquid metal that we use is liquid tin. It's similar to solder, and so it's very abundant. And we pump the liquid metal past these giant light bulbs, and the liquid metal will heat up to almost the same temperature as the light bulb element. And so that, for us, is about 2,400 degrees Celsius, so glowing white hot, similar to an incandescent light bulb filament. And we then use that liquid metal to move the heat over to a different location where we have the storage bank of the energy, which is where we have giant graphite blocks. So graphite is basically like what you have in pencil lead. It's very inexpensive. And so that material, although it seems simple, is actually very abundant, very inexpensive, and also very refractory, meaning that it can stay solid at extremely high temperatures without turning into a liquid or gas. And so it turns out that graphite is actually good to about 3,000 degrees Celsius, so even hotter than we're planning to use it. And so the liquid metal flows past these graphite blocks and then heats the blocks all the way up to the peak temperature. And that's the nominally 2,400 degrees Celsius. And then that's how we charge up the thermal battery. We make the blocks extremely hot from electricity. Then when we want electricity back, we pump the liquid metal again through the blocks. So the liquid metal comes out at the same temperature as the blocks. And we run it over to what we call a power conversion unit. So this is our, you know, usually what you'd use here is like a turbine or some kind of heat engine to go from heat to electricity. And in our case, part of the reason we took the temperature so hot is so we could use something else that's very unconventional. And there's a reason, there's good reason for it, which is we actually use solar panels to do the conversion of the heat back to electricity. And so if you imagine these pipes, they're all glowing white hot. We have specially designed photovoltaic panels that actually convert the light coming off of the piping. And that converts some of the heat back to electricity. And that's how you put electricity back on the grid. And as a consequence of removing that energy from the liquid metal, it cools down. And then you send it back to this giant bank of graphite blocks to get reheated. And that's how we discharge the system.
You are listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney on WBAI 99.5 FM New York. Today we are speaking with Dr. Asegun Henry about renewable energy and boxing up the sun. Dr. Henry is a mechanical engineering professor at MIT. Now, just a quick reminder before we get back to the interview, the fundraising drive is over. Thank you very much for your support. But you can always go to WBAI.org and make a one-time contribution or become a monthly sustainer. A $25 contribution automatically qualifies you to be a voting member of the station. And by the way, if you like this show, you can always click WBAI's Extinction Rebellion link and become, through your contribution, a WBAI buddy in the name of this show. So take a moment if you can and become an Extinction Rebellion buddy.
So Ashagun, I want to make sure I understand a couple of important things for my own, but also to summarize things for listeners. So there exists some battery technology now. Yours is essentially bigger, better, and cheaper. And the huge difference is that it will allow, maybe there's more than one difference, but one of the really big differences is that the current battery technology could not allow for a total non-decarbonization of the energy grid, but yours could if it were deployed at scale. Is that fair?
Right. That is fair. That's correct.
And you talked us through some of the particulars, but it works essentially by taking electricity, converting it to heat, moving it around amongst this graphite as heat. And when more electricity is needed, that heat can become electricity again. So it goes electricity to heat to electricity. Is that right?
You get it. That's perfect. You got it.
Awesome. Thank you.
You said in the MIT news article that you decided to teach at MIT because you saw it as, quote, a path towards saving the human race, end quote. Now, what did you mean by that? And do you see this box up the sun system as a path towards saving the human race? And if so, how?
That's a great question. And so yeah, in short, moving from the school I was at previously, Georgia Tech, to MIT was one of the hardest decisions I've had to make. I was very happy at Georgia Tech, loved it there, and in many ways missed Atlanta. But at the end of the day, you know, I became concerned that I had this invention, I had this idea, and that I might get overlooked on my own invention, that other competitors would come and take it, run with it. And the Georgia Tech profile or the exposure that I had being at Georgia Tech may not have been sufficient to really get me access to the kind of people, resources, investors, things like that to be able to move it forward. And so moving to MIT, I think has maximized that as best as I could hope for. This interview is a great example that I didn't get interviews like this back when I was at Georgia Tech, despite the fact that we're doing, I think, same quality of work. And so I think the MIT brand and the MIT engine of MIT News and all the publicity that comes from things we do there has helped to expose what we're doing so that more people will know about it and hopefully can get involved. How I think it will ultimately end up contributing very significantly to saving human beings from extinction is that the path that we are on right now, the business as usual path, is one that will put us in a position where we will eventually get to a tipping point beyond which there will be essentially nothing we can do to try to undo the damage that we've done to our climate and the Earth's response, which is very long time scale, may possibly result in human beings going extinct via other species going extinct. There are a variety of possible modalities that could lead to that. And so from my standpoint, when I was at Georgia Tech, I really viewed this technology, this idea as a potential path to not having that happen. And what that entails is this issue of storing solar energy or renewable energy in a battery is so profoundly impactful if we can do it. And the reason I say that is because about 25% of global CO2 emissions come from electricity production. And if we deploy this fully, we would be able to abate that. So if you add to that, if we're able to decarbonize transportation, which accounts for another about 14 to 15% of global CO2 emissions, we can abate the transportation sector emissions by switching to electric vehicles. But where are those electric vehicles going to get their energy? They're going to get it from the grid. And so ultimately, by decarbonizing the grid, you can supply the energy for the transportation sector as well. And so now you're talking about in total abating about 40% of global CO2 emissions, which is almost half, with essentially one technology, you know, one breakthrough technology that can ultimately abate almost half of the problem. And so from my view, from my standpoint, it's hugely impactful. And it's really just an important and critical path that we try to get this developed and deployed immediately.
So what are the prospects for that, for deploying this at scale quickly?
The main thing is, you know, for us to continue developing it in my lab right now, we are trying to build a fully functioning laboratory scale prototype. So we're making good progress on that. We have already demonstrated a couple of years ago one of the other key components, which I mentioned, liquid metal being pumped around. So prior to about, I would say 2016 or so, there was no such thing as a liquid metal pump that could operate as hot as we operate ours. So we set the Guinness Book of World Records for the highest temperature pump on record. And that's a new and important breakthrough that allows the entire system to operate, making the pumps, the valves, the seals, the pipes, all those things are our main contribution. And then in addition to that, most recently, we've worked with some collaborators at National Renewable Energy Lab to demonstrate these special PV cells that I mentioned that are used to convert our heat back to electricity. So our goal, our target is to get those to 50% efficiency. The record for those specific type of PV cells, which are called often called thermal photovoltaic cells because they are converting energy from a heat source. And those cells, the record for their efficiency was at about 29% about 40 years ago. About a year ago, someone pushed it up to about 32%. And most recently, we actually just demonstrated 42%. So we just set a new world record for the photovoltaic efficiency as well. So I think we are well on our way towards meeting our 50% goal. And I think those are some of the critical pieces that are going to come together. And the next steps for us are really to pull some money together, looking for partners and investors to try and build and also government resources to try and build a 1 megawatt hour pilot scale demonstration. I'm hopeful that we'll get some partners together later this year and seek to try and build something next year. And after that, that'll be like the unit module for a larger system. And then we'll be looking to build systems that are 50 to 100 times bigger than that, just multiple units stacked on top of each other, so to speak.
Outside of academia, are you activated regarding the climate crisis, for instance, grassroots organizing or things of that sort? If not, by the way, I can see how teaching at MIT plus saving the human race through energy storage might take up most of your time.
I am not as engaged as I would like to be. I think that it's something that I'm extremely passionate about. It's literally, you know, what I eat, sleep, and breathe. That said, I'm very interested in getting more active. I think that I'm a very strong believer. I spent some time working at the Department of Energy, and during that time, I became very convinced very quickly that even if today we had our solution and we had dispatchable renewable energy deployable anywhere in the world cheaper than fossil fuels, that there's another problem we have to solve, which is policy. Mm-hmm. And that at the end of the day, policies will be the most important and critical factor that becomes the barrier to the actual deployment. So, you know, the task that we have before us is effectively a complete overhaul of the entire power infrastructure. That's a many trillion dollar infrastructure. And so the question becomes, where's all that money going to come from? You know, basically we have to replace it with something new that doesn't pollute the environment. And the basic question of where's all the money going to come from to pay for all that is not a well answered question. But at the end of the day, I think it's going to require government level investment able to do these kinds of things. This isn't going to be something easy for just a bunch of venture capitalists to do.
You are listening to WBAI's Extinction Rebellion Radio with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. And we are speaking with MIT Mechanical Engineering Professor Ashagun Henry about his potentially revolutionary idea for capturing and storing renewable energy. Ashagun, this is fascinating. If people are listening and they're as fascinated as we are by this idea, they want to learn more about your laboratory's work. Maybe there's even an investor out there listening. How do they learn about it?
Yeah, most of my stuff's on the web. If you just Google my name, A-S-E-G-U-N, I'm pretty much, I think, the only one with that name that you'll find on Google. It's a unique name. I'm not the only one with that name. But if you type that name in Google, you'll find me. You'll find my web webpage at MIT. You'll find my research laboratory's webpage, and you should be able to find lots of details. And there's probably, I think, videos of me talking about this on YouTube, a variety of different resources so you could get up to speed. And it's easy to find my contact information. You can email me, and we can set up a meeting and try to talk through some details.
Thank you so much for joining
us
today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
This is Hannah from WBAI's Premiums Department. As you may know, WBAI now has a new phone number to call to make donations or to pledge for premiums at 212-209-2950. Thank you for being a WBAI member and for making a contribution to keep the station afloat. But if you have a question about a premium, please do not call that number. All the call center can do is take down the info and send it to premiums@wbai.org, and time on the line costs us money. Instead, please email us directly with your question or concern. The email is premiums@wbai.org or call 212-209-2870. We promise to get back to you within a week's time. Again, please call 212-209-2870 if you have a question about a premium you ordered, or email premiums@wbai.org.
Dear WBAI listener, we can certainly use a little help from our friends. After years of falling behind under new management, Pacifica has now gotten its financial papers in order and can apply once again for grants. That means WBAI, which is owned by the nonprofit Pacifica Foundation, can also apply for funding. And we are looking for a pro bono grant writer to help our 61-year-old station by writing grants for us. If you have time, expertise, and interest, please contact Bertol, our station manager, at bertol@wbai.org. You'd be helping to ensure the stability and growth of this historic listener-sponsored radio station. With details, please email bertol@wbai.org. That's B-E-R-T-H-O-L-D, bertol@wbai.org, with grant writer in the subject heading. Many thanks. Many, many thanks. This is listener-sponsored WBAI New York. Activist Sharon Salam speaks out for WBAI.
We should be moving forward, collecting the funds that we need to make sure that our station is whole and that it can do its job as it has done for me in the past. When all of this stuff happened to me many, many years ago in 1989, I didn't get very many opportunities to speak out in regards to the wrong that was done to my son and the other boys in the Central Park jogger case, as it was called at that time. Very few people stepped up. Yes, Like It Is was there. WBAI was there, and a few others. Majority of those stations that let people like myself speak and tell them what was going on the other side, those stations are gone. If we lose WBAI, where do we go to get our words out? Where do we go if you've been arrested unjustly? Where do you go if someone's taken your children unfairly? Where do you go to seek justice? We must keep this station alive. Alive. WBAI.
No justice.
This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
previous program was Extinction Rebellion Radio, heard Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. right after the W.